Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal, which aims to make sense of our COVID-19 world today and tomorrow. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by Kathleen Higgins, who teaches and writes on Nietzsche, aesthetics, and philosophy of emotion at the University of Texas at Austin. She's also published a number of books, Nietzsche's Zarathustra, The Music of Our Lives, A Short History of Philosophy, A Passion for Wisdom, What Nietzsche Really Said, The Music Between Us, Is Music a Universal Language? And she's also edited or co-edited several other books on topics such as German idealism, aesthetics, ethics, erotic love, non-Western philosophy, and the philosophy of Robert C. Solomon. She's been a visiting fellow at the Faculty of Psychology and Educational Sciences at Catholic University Leuven, visiting fellow of the Australian National University Philosophy Department and Canberra School of Music, and resident scholar at the Rockefeller Foundation's Bellagio Study and Conference Center. She's also received an Alumni Achievement Award from the Conservatory of Music at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and she's also been a frequent visitor to the Philosophy Department at the University of Auckland. And she's president of the American Society for Aesthetics. So, Kathleen, welcome, and how are you?
Just fine. Although I'm actually past president, my term has expired.
Oh, right, because I stand corrected in a sort of a perfect sort of post-truth moment. And actually, on that exact point, Kathleen, as we were talking earlier on, I mean, I read your absolutely fantastic piece recently in a great issue of the great special collector's edition, in fact, of the Scientific American magazine, which I'll point all the listeners towards. The entire issue is titled Truth Versus Lies. And your piece about post-truth, a guide for the perplexed. If politicians can lie without condemnation, what are scientists to do? Was absolutely excellent. So, Kathleen, I know it's a huge question, but go on then. Post-truth, what's it all about?
Well, I think the way the term is usually used, the idea is that we're past an era in which truth really matters to people. I hope that that's not the case, but I think the sense in which people tend to talk a lot about false news reports, well, not just talk a lot about it, I think can verify that there are false news reports, and the way the term fake news gets flung around, regardless of whether or not the news is fake or not, indicates that truth is something that people are thinking a lot about these days and are a little bit wary of in many instances, or at least wary of claims to truth.
Mm-hmm. As you say in the piece, don't bother me with facts is no longer a punchline. It's become a political stance.
Sadly, I'm afraid that's so.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so just in terms of taking us through your viewpoints on all things post-truth related, when you're lecturing on this, when you're talking about this with students, how do you, if you like, lay out a timeline of post-truth?
Well, I guess to some extent I would go back to Kant and talk about the basic claim in his philosophy that our minds do a lot of processing after we take in sense data from the world. And that in itself means that what we take to be truth is something that our faculties work on before we can really internalize it. Something like a computer program, things have to be converted to a form in which a computer can use them. Similarly, whatever we take in through our senses has to be converted into a form that our minds can use. What that means is that, in fact, we have a lot in common with the way every other human being internalizes input from the environment. But it also means that what we take in from the environment has a certain human form that reality in itself, this is Kant's big point, doesn't have or doesn't necessarily have. There's no reason to think that it has that shape. And that, I think, was a beginning philosophically for people to begin to challenge or worry about whether or not the kinds of things that they had thought to be true of the world were in fact true in this absolute fundamental sense. That shouldn't really give anyone pause with regard to how convinced they are by what they can see with their own eyes. Although, given that we have to interpret everything, maybe one should pause a little bit, but one shouldn't pause on the basis of the fact that our human faculties go to work on whatever we take in. Nevertheless, that means that what we take in isn't reality in itself. From that starting point, other thinkers began to worry about how far off we might be from what reality is in itself. And also, something that I'm especially interested in, how much perspective affects the way we understand things. Because things are processed through our minds, and in any case, we have to interpret what to make of what comes through our mental faculties. That means that there are possibilities of multiple perspectives on the same thing. And that too led to a certain maybe credibility gap for some people between what they had thought to be true and what they felt they could really rely on. I think the solution to that is simply to pool as many perspectives as possible and see what seems to be reliable after that. But some people would see all of this as eroding the idea of truth.
Eroding the idea of truth. And obviously one goes right back to Plato, who held truth to be the ultimate goal of philosophy. And what about the issue of, and then we'll sort of no doubt leap around wildly as we go through this, but you're an absolute expert on Nietzsche, and obviously with my schoolboy knowledge of this, I just look back to the endlessly quoted, "There are no facts, only interpretations," perspectivism, that for which he is, amongst many other things, utterly renowned.
True. Although one of the contexts in which he says that, he claims there are no moral facts, only moral interpretations of facts.
And then how does that sit, again, we'll leap around before we get into this, with, later the postmodern thinkers like Derrida or Foucault, who basically saw truth as something to be attacked at all times?
Well, I think that one of the things, and I think Nietzsche is a little bit responsible for this too, all of those postmodern authors frequently have the tendency not to distinguish in the way that they refer when they're saying what is taken to be true as truth, as opposed to what actually is true, because they think that when you make claims to truth, you're not acknowledging your own perspectival relationship to the facts. Because of that blurring of the distinction between what the facts are and one's own take on the facts, I think that a lot of the discussion gets pretty muddy pretty fast.
Okay. And then in terms of the discussions getting pretty muddy pretty fast, and I know you mentioned in your piece, one of the, certainly the sources you mentioned, one of the authors you refer to obviously is Ralph Keyes' excellent book, The Post-Truth Era, which came out, about whatever it is, sort of 15 years ago or so. Meanwhile, what's your take on I mean, certainly when I wrote about this, you know, I basically pinned it all fairly or unfairly on a certain Ronnie Reagan and the idea of, you know, a Reagan lying to the American people. But, you know, the playwright Steve Tesage saying that we were in a sort of we were faced with a government of lies and no one seemed to mind.
Ah, well, I don't know exactly. I think there could be a lot of threads in the causality that led to a situation in which people don't seem to mind being lied to. One thing that crosses my mind a lot when I wonder why people believe what they do is I think a lot of people just can't internalize the idea that people who are in a position to know or in a position of authority would deliberately lie to them as a strategy. It's really hard. I mean, I've found myself to have difficulty with this when someone is asserting something to you, maybe face to face or via a screen, and seems completely convinced, gives all the evidence of being completely convinced. It's just really hard to believe that people in that situation would be lying. I think that it's partly because of people's good nature. I think also human beings are probably, to use the common metaphor, wired to take seriously what other people tell them. And they take information to be credible until shown otherwise. That's why the Boy Who Cried Wolf story is so poignant, because it takes a while for people to start to think, ah, this is not a credible source. And sometimes, unfortunately, well, people just don't ever recognize incredible sources as not being credible, because there are many things in the environment that encourage their believability. For example, they're covered by news sources. Of course, the news sources themselves may not be credible, but again, people have to already be suspicious, I think, before they tend to doubt what they hear and what they see and what they read.
I mean, that personally, as a sort of, you know, as a sort of a personal perspective on that, is certainly that one can look to the world of advertising, which has always been about the manipulation of emotion and the bending of the truth, to put it politely, as a way of selling us more stuff. And, you know, agencies always say that feelings beat facts. I mean, there's a point, I think, you know, the journalist Michael Deacon wrote years ago, before, and we'll talk no doubt about the large orange man who's still currently sort of barricaded inside the White House. But, you know, he wrote about, you know, it's why modern political campaigners love using the words positive, negative, optimism, pessimism, as they enable easy dismissal of criticism. Thus, a politician who lies is running a positive campaign while opponents are engaged in personal attacks. It's simple but effective. Facts are negative. Facts are pessimistic. Facts are unpatriotic.
Oh, dear. Yes, facts have a political stance, right?
Yes. Exactly. I mean, just on that as a side, I mean, how has it been for someone like you, who I know, a renowned deep thinker, just, if you like, the lived experience of, you know, the last few years, where, you know, experts have been derided, where, you know, yes, where obviously, you know, certainly, sort of, you know, Trump has had a what the most generous person could be say would say is an elastic link with the truth. I mean, and yet, as you point out in your piece there, that one of the odd things about all things alternative facts and post-truth is politicians that use that sort of a angle actually rely on our reliance on truth to actually make their lies work.
Yes. I think one problem that we have is just the fact that whenever you interpret, you want to come up with what the upshot of the data you're taking in is. For that reason, I think we tend to be a little bit too impressed with overly simplistic statements that seem to harness together a lot of data that we have. And oversimplification, I think, is always the enemy of truth. That's why I think it's important to take into account as many different perspectives on things as one can and try to sift through that to gain something that one can make use of.
Okay.
The philosophical theory called the pragmatic theory of truth acknowledges that what we take to be the truth has to be understood in a provisional way. We don't necessarily know all the facts, nor do we necessarily have theories that can make sense of them at the time. And so we have to be prepared to adjust our interpretations. But for some people, that already sounds like you're modifying what the truth is. The fact is that a lot of times what we take to be true is formulated in the way we think about it in such theory-laden ways that we can't really get beyond the theory unless we work pretty hard at inspecting our assumptions over and over again. And that's precisely what people who are trying to persuade people quickly don't want people to do and don't encourage. So I think that's the problems that we have. There's also the problem politically in that people like being entertained. So dismissive statement by a politician, well, that'll be tweeted all over the place. It'll be presented on newscasts. And it does indeed. I mean, this is one of the places where I think the emotional reaction in some sense does, I hate to say Trump, but facts oftentimes simply because people are looking for entertainment and aren't necessarily clear in their own minds as to which motive guides them at the moment, the desire for entertainment or the desire for the facts of the matter.
Okay. And then what about to go back slightly to one of the points you're making there in terms of, you know, you talked about oversimplification is an enemy of truth. Now, as an expert as you are about Nietzsche, I know, again, you mentioned Nietzsche a couple of times in that piece in Scientific American, and we talk about him saying, three cheers for physics and even more for the motive that spurs us towards physics, our honesty. Can you just talk, please, about the idea of Nietzsche and truth, and perhaps how we can be perhaps sort of true to ourselves as individuals, you know, how we can be authentic, how we can be, you know, the real us. I mean, I know that he was fascinated by individuality, and he was very sort of anti-conformist, like the sort of the cynics of ancient Greece. But can you talk about Nietzsche and the individual and realness and all the rest of it?
Yeah, well, I think actually his interest in the individual guides some of his more complicated statements about truth. In an early essay, he says, what are our truths? A handful of mobile metaphors. And he compares the kind of metaphors that we use in our everyday language to coins that have rubbed down to the point that you can no longer see what was inscribed on the coin. He thinks that we do tend a lot to conformity. And oftentimes when he's complaining about truth, he is complaining about the idea that one has something that is absolute and permanent, the notion that Plato had of truth, as opposed to something that is usable and often formulated in metaphoric terms that we have to assimilate and may need to revise over time. The individual, as he sees it, is too often subdued by impressions that they've gotten from the crowd. And this is one of the ways in which power is gained over people. They feel the need to conform. They certainly want to be part of their society and to relate to other people. And that makes it very easy for them to just slip into common ways of talking without really giving much thought to whether or not it holds up or is usable to them in their circumstances. So, I mean, that's important to him. And he often talks about the idea of becoming who one is, you are. a line that he quotes from Pindar. And I think what he means by that is that one has a lot of potential to really individuate, to use a kind of Jungian term, to take the resources that one has available in one's personality and character and circumstances and do something creative with them, and creative in such a way that it fulfills one's own life and contributes to a larger society. All of those things, I think, are important to him, but he thinks too often we're subdued by pronouncements that appear to be the truth, and we try to subordinate ourselves to whatever we think the upshot of that is. Though it may well be that other people are mobilizing what's being claimed to be truth in that context.
And does that link to his thinking also around in the political context? Am I right thinking he was skeptical of democracy?
Yes.
And if so, why?
Well, he was skeptical of democracy because, again, he thought that it required people to subordinate their own internal critical judgment and perceptions to party lines. So he has a comment about parliamentarianism, and he says, well, yeah, this seems to give one options. One has maybe five options, but if one has any other view besides the five, one's still left out. Now, what would be a better form of government? Some people have argued that the only way to realize some of Nietzsche's values would be a democratic form of government, or at least it's the best we've got going. Sometimes Nietzsche talks as though he thinks that there ought to be an aristocracy, and he clearly thinks there ought to be an aristocracy of cultural leaders, a kind of cultural aristocracy. But how that would translate into practical living or practical politics is far from clear.
And on that point again that you mentioned earlier on about and therefore that linking into politicians, and you mentioned, you know, people like being entertained, and obviously at the moment we've still unfortunately got an ex-entertainer sort of in the White House. What about so even though people like being entertained, and often one can say they almost like being in on the act, that they know they're being lied to, but it's a lie they like. You talk about, you know, the arrogance and contempt of the powerful political lie.
Yeah, one of Nietzsche's lines, I mean, I'll probably keep coming up with them.
Sure, totally.
One is that he claims they never doubted their right to lie when he is complaining about leaders of religious institutions or political institutions of the past. That basically, I mean, Plato in his Republic famously suggests that it's not inappropriate for leaders to lie. That makes you kind of wonder about Plato's commitment to the truth ultimately, although admittedly, Socrates say this. But this idea that one can lie with a good conscience or for a good purpose, I think that one of the questions that you asked brings up the issue of what's the relationship between the facts and being true to oneself or true to one's own judgment. And those are somewhat, I mean, they're certainly related, but they're somewhat different emphases. Facts seem to be matters of the external world. How do things stand? And then there's also a kind of truth with respect to how do I stand in relationship to those facts? But there's also a sense of maybe a kind of integrity of personality or an attempt to somehow bring one's powers together in relating to the rest of the world. And that makes all of this much more of a psychological matter than maybe on the surface it sounds like. I mean, it sounds like the facts, what could be more straightforward than that? But once you start talking about a human being actually making use of facts or ascertaining what the facts are, that's going to involve interpretation, and that's going to be based in part on how they look at the world and what position they occupy within their society in relation to others.
Yeah. And on that point about being true to oneself, you spoke about Kant earlier on. Now, I mean, Kant was the obviously the champion of autonomy, along with many other things. So can you perhaps just talk a bit about that, what autonomy is really all about from Kant's perspective?
Well, from Kant's perspective, what it's about is that from the standpoint of morality, it's really our own reason that is dictating morality to us. So he would say, one of his famous examples is promise keeping. He would say there's a deep irrationality if you make a promise with the intention of not fulfilling it, because you're essentially relying on an institution that if others occupied the same position you are, namely false promisers, pretty soon that institution would fall apart. You can have the institution of promising with and support it enough to make use of it without your mind endorsing it at the same time, if you're immoral, as you are going to backtrack on that endorsement. So he sees a kind of connection between autonomy, this giving the moral law to oneself, and rationality. I think, however, many people would say that autonomy depends on other matters as well. I mean, many times we talk about autonomy in relationship to government. Do we have the ability to make our own decisions? And people have all kinds of senses in which they would hold that this is an acceptable way in which we can be governed, and this is unacceptable because it interferes with our autonomy. But our autonomy also has to do with a kind of harmony of the faculties. And here's a place where I'm certainly going to agree with Plato, the idea that if we have our emotions pulling in one direction and some reasoning pulling in another direction without trying to bring the two into some kind of harmony, we've got a problem. And Kant pay much attention to emotion. What most of us are trying to do in our lives is somehow make what we understand by means of reason and the things that we care about through our emotions come into some kind of coherent form so that we can live out the kinds of things that we care about and commit ourselves to those and do so effectively by using our reason to do that.
And on that thing about the battle between, or whatever, the tension between sort of emotions and reasoning, I'm right in thinking that so that was all about something like Rousseau. So Rousseau was very into just go with your passion, go with what you sort of instant thinking, as it were, and don't try and over-rationalize stuff. Don't try and overthink it by reasoning. Would that be fair to say?
Well, yes, but I think the don't try to overthink it is one of his important insights. Acting on passion, a lot of times we think of that in connection with court cases in which it is an act of passion where someone really couldn't control themselves. But there are passions that have a much more long-term form. I mean, one passionately committed to a cause or to caring for members of one's family. Those are passions too. They're just often not thought of in terms of this knee-jerk reaction. I think the idea of not overthinking things, on the other hand, is really an important point. And I tend to take inspiration in this connection from the Taoist school of Chinese thought. The Taoists think that there is a danger of overthinking. Partly the danger is that one becomes rigid in one's views about things and doesn't allow anything new to come in. I think this is part of what Rousseau is concerned with as well. One's own perceptions and making sense of the world by means of them that allows one to adjust and respond to one's situation regularly and routinely. We stick so much to something that we dogmatically hold to be true that we don't allow our perceptions to allow us to reconsider things. And that's another reason why I think Nietzsche has important things to say about the truth. We need to be able to reconsider. And so if we're understanding something to be true in terms that we're not able to be flexible with or to flexibly apply to the situation as it changes and as it flows, then what we have really isn't the truth, but something that's relatively dead. I think he's closer to a notion of living truth than to the idea of sticking to one's formulas. And that's what I see the Taoists as constantly reminding us of, too.
Okay. And then I know you also you've also written a great deal about the issue of German idealism, of which my knowledge, I have to admit, is absolutely zero, apart from knowing a minimal amount about sort of Hegel and Schopenhauer. So go on then. So German idealism, talk us through that, if you would.
Right. Well, the German idealists followed Kant. And they wanted to see how far one could go with this realization that what we internalize as the truth or the situation within the world isn't something that is exactly a mirror of the universe, but instead is affected by our own faculties. The German idealists tended to see reality as, in fact, a matter of our ideas. And so Hegel is interested in the way ideas change by means of setting up a certain way of looking at the world and then starting to recognize that it's incomplete. And so he talks about the way society has to reformulate what it's taking to be the big picture of the world over and over because it keeps leaving things out. And sometimes it becomes aware of what it's left out by means of conflict. And so he sees the development of human history as always on this track of trying to get a more comprehensive picture of reality. And for him, that's decisive in the way history has moved. Humanity is trying to make the world more and more its home, and does this by means of ideas, and those ideas have their own lifespan because something else needs to be taken into account. This has sometimes been formulated, I think not by Hegel himself, as thesis, antithesis, synthesis, that you have some view of reality and then something that contradicts that comes into view, and what one has to do at that point is synthesize them. So that's how he took the progress of truth. We became more aware of more of reality and brought it into some kind of resonance with what humanity wants to do. And that project guides us forward until we reach the point that we have the big picture in its entirety. Seems a little improbable that there would ever be such a point, because you'd still have to formulate the idea and then you'd have challenges to any formulation. But that's his view. Schopenhauer, on the other hand, tended to stick more with the basic Kantian idea that the world as we perceive it is something that is affected by our faculties. And he brought this into a connection with Asian thought, especially the thought of the Buddha. Schopenhauer was convinced that the Buddha was right, that if we came to see things more adequately, we would end the kind of self-centered craving that leads to suffering. For him, reality, interestingly enough, is will, this chaotic willfulness. And so it's a dynamic picture of reality, but that dynamic picture of reality that wants control over the environment in the case of each of us often leads us into conflict. So he has a pessimistic view in that he thinks the way to gain insight is to move ourselves as much as possible out of real insistence on life and instead to distance ourselves as much as possible from it and relinquish our attachment to our own will. That, he thinks, would lead to inner peace. I don't think that Buddhists necessarily would see much of their own interpretation of Buddhism in the way Schopenhauer spoke of things, but what he has to say touches on truth insofar as he thinks that there is a kind of truth having to do with the way that we see reality by virtue of our faculties, but the fundamental truth is that all is one, and that if we somehow recognize that fact, then we have the potential to gain peace in our lives. Otherwise, we're going to continue to flounder.
Absolutely fascinating. Can I ask, again, just leading that point on, you mentioned there one of the comments you made about Schopenhauer there was talking about, you know, the sort of self-centered cravings, whatever. And, you know, perhaps someone who's like deified the individual, whatever, but sort of, you know, obviously Sartre, you know, the talked about the sort of the classic existential hero who had to be free in every sort of a possible permutation of that point. Someone who understand it sort of rather put the brakes on that was the wonderful Iris Murdoch, who talked about the need for empathy. We couldn't be utterly free because we would just be effectively sort of utterly out of control and possibly utterly selfish and self-centered, leading to sort of damage to others. Now, on that point about Iris Murdoch, what about this issue that I heard a very good talk recently about a very good book that's just come out called The Philosopher Queens, that was edited by Rebecca Buxton and Lisa Whiting. And they talk about the history of philosophy has not done women justice. Where are you on that? Where are the female philosophers not lauded as they should be?
Well, this reminds me of the title of a famous article in Art History, Where Are All the Great Women Artists? In which Linda Nochlin, the author, argued that there wasn't a social support that enabled people with the talent to develop, if they happen to be female, in anything like the way men did. And she mentions all kinds of institutional barriers to doing that. I'm sure that women have as much philosophical talent as men, but there are a lot of social circumstances that militate against it. In fact, I mean, I would have thought that the percentage of people going to, say, grad school in philosophy would be more or less half and half, but that doesn't seem to be the case. And there have been a lot of reflections on why that's so. And there can be lots of different factors that play a role. For example, it became a very popular game or mode of philosophizing at some point, some decades ago, to engage in a really combative style, at least in the United States, and I think probably in the UK as well. And some people speculated that that might not appeal to many women, given the socialization of women, whatever you want to say about the nature-nurture background of that. I mean, it does seem that strikes me as a perfectly reasonable consideration, although it's probably more the case that the lack of confidence shown by various people in higher positions in the field may have discouraged a lot of women as well. I'm certain that's happened in some instances. So there is a lot of discussion going on in the United States currently about why women are so little reflected in the field. But if you look back in history, many of them didn't learn to read and write to the same extent as men did in certain contexts. They weren't necessarily educated in the same way. And insofar as some knowledge of what's gone before is important, if you aren't educated to do that, it's not very easy to get into the conversation. So, yeah, I think maybe a way to summarize it is if you look at the history of philosophy as a long conversation, if women weren't admitted to the conversation in the first place, obviously they're not going to show up on the pages of history books.
Yeah. Okay. Fascinating. Okay. Well, in the last sort of quarter of an hour or so, and it's been absolutely fascinating so far. What about the, again, I know that, again, you also co-edited amongst the many books you co-edited and worked on and whatever, the philosophy of Robert C. Solomon. And now as, and just looking at, and say, I'm looking at through the prism of, let's say, ethics, when ethics appear to be in fairly short supply on a corporate level. So perhaps you can just talk to us about that, you know, perhaps through the perspective of, you know, whatever, Aristotle and authenticity and why one does the right thing and all the rest of it. But yeah, so ethics, ethics in 2020, where can one find them?
Right. And you're connecting this to Bob, who in fact was my late husband, that he worked in business ethics.
Mm-hmm.
That's a connection.
Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah.
Part of what Bob would emphasize when he was talking about ethics and Aristotle is the idea of us being social animals and thriving in a context in which we're part of a thriving community, that business can be viewed as a way of contributing to society and being a part of that. And virtue is what Aristotle tended to focus on. Virtue wasn't something, as Aristotle saw it, that one did to one's own disadvantage. Virtue was something that enabled you to excel in your context. Some of the emphases in this line of thinking would be aspiring to excellence in business. You could consider this in terms of making an excellent product, in contributing to the world in a positive way, and in thriving yourself financially by virtue of playing a role as a virtuous member of a community. That's a very different model from simply trying to see how much you can profit from having a zero-sum game in which you can only profit if somebody else is losing.
Yeah.
So this idea of building a whole community as front and center, and a business as being in business to provide something that is of use to the community, that would be a way of orienting oneself in business according to that model.
Okay. So in that case, would it be fair to say that your fantastic late ex-husband, the great Bob Solomon, would have been at one end of the scale and a certain Mr. Trump would have been at the other?
Probably fair to say.
Okay, so looking to the future then, rather the near future or long-term future, so for yourself then, on a sort of on a personal angle, I mean, I've tended to sort of position most of these podcasts, loosely or not, around the issues of hope, community, and resilience. So from your perspective, perhaps just talk to us a bit about that in terms of hope, community, and resilience, what they mean to you, and where you think they're sitting right now in late 2020.
Well, hope may be, in fact, in short supply for a lot of people because there have been so many things that the world has been dealing with this year in particular. I really like another line from Nietzsche, which he says through his spokesperson Zarathustra, place little good perfect things around you. What is perfect teaches hope.
Mm.
And I think that it's important to keep in mind that it really doesn't necessarily require already having accomplished everything that one hopes for in order to sustain hope. It's simply important to have the sense of something succeeding. And so to sustain hope, I think it is useful to try to arrange for things to be as good or perfect as possible, maybe in small ways. I mean, to use a very pedestrian analogy, order is often something that one finds lacking in one's immediate environment, at least I do. And simply straightening a closet, that gives me such a positive sense of where things might go. I think that the idea of realizing one's hopes in small ways can help one sustain hope.
Mm.
With regard to community, I think that too often there's a sense of a dichotomy between the individual and community, when in fact a community is formed of individuals, and a community can be at war with itself when the individuals are at war with each other, or a community can thrive because different people who differ from each other have different strengths to offer, and what serves as a strength or a weakness differs in different contexts. So I think thinking of being a part of a community not as being a matter of subduing oneself, but of realizing oneself as fully as possible in consort with other people, I think that's a useful way to think about that. And when it comes to resilience, I think that obviously that's something that we need to be focused on. In a way, it's closely related to hope. Probably the way in which I tend to think of resilience is trying to figure out some way of rising to the occasion. Like when a situation is difficult, obviously, often one simply wants to resist it or to just reverse the way things are. But to try to view it as a challenge to which that does present an occasion to which one can rise, just kind of focusing on how to direct yourself in that way. What would it take? I remember a friend who had a diagnosis of cancer. And he said, I decided that whatever happened, I wanted to make myself proud of how I behaved. I thought that was really good advice to himself. And I think maybe advice internally to how to be resilient is something like that. You may not be able to see what's coming, but what kind of person do you want to be as you approach it? And what maybe small step can you take now to try to rise to the occasion, whatever it may be? And because I have spent a lot of time thinking about music, I think music can be of great use here, because music is itself moves us into the future. And typically, music does this in a way that is convincing in its own right. It has a kind of inner structural truth to itself, and it's moving somewhere. I think that can actually help us a lot. And so finding music as background as one is attempting to become more resilient is often a really useful thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Absolutely beautifully put. Okay, so just in terms of everyone being aware of where they could track you down in terms of things like sort of social media, where they can read more about you, those of who are listening in from various parts of the world. Yeah, where can they find you?
Only on email. I'm not a big enthusiast of social media, to put it.
Okay.
I think there's too much oversimplification on it. So only email.
Okay. Okay. In that case, so just a final question then. And I know it's you've covered some really, really big topics there and some epically big thinkers and fantastic points of view. Yeah, if one could try to summarize your perspective on all things post-truth and where we are now as we quite frankly hopefully leave behind the appalling Trump era, let's call it out for what it is, that grotesque individual, post-truth, truth, reality, honesty and all the rest of it. I mean, honesty has taken a bit of a kicking over the last few years. How do you see things playing out from a sort of a, perhaps a philosophical and a sort of a existential perspective?
Well, what I hope is that people will start to recognize that oversimplification is the enemy. It's not our friend, even though it can sometimes seem that way. Of course, we have to draw conclusions and act on them in different times and places. But I guess perhaps focusing on the courage to go with the flow in the sense of allowing oneself to be responsive to the situation and keep responding, I think that's got to be part of a solution. Will people be persuaded to do that? Well, I suppose that remains to be seen, but I hope so.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely fantastic stuff. Well, look, Kathleen, thank you so much. That was a real, has to be said, tour de force talk through a whole range of absolutely fascinating perspectives and points of view. So Kathleen Higgins, who teaches and writes on Nietzsche, aesthetics and the philosophy of emotion at the University of Texas, thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please leave a rating, tell your friends, and until next time, goodbye.